Pseudopod, episode 136, April 3rd, 2009. This week's story, The Eyes of the Crowd, by Bruce Boston. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Bruce Boston. It first appeared in Nocturne, issue 1, way back in 1988, and was reprinted in The Mask of Dreams, an anthology of Bruce's work that Wildside published in 2001. Bruce is the author of more than 40 books and chapbooks, and has received numerous awards, including the Bram Stoker, the Pushcart, and the Asimov Readers Award. You can find out more about him at bruceboston.com. Your narrator this week is Matthew Wayne Selznick, a tireless podcaster, writer, and social media consultant, who is best known for the superb Brave Men Run, one of my favourite podcast novels. However, Matt also has countless other projects on the go, as well as helping other authors and creative people establish an online audience and unique brand. Go to mattselznick.com to find out more about podcasting's premier Renaissance man. They say that travelling is better than arriving, so pack your bags and keep them close, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Eyes of the Crowd, by Bruce Boston. At the Stefanov station where Villers checked his bags, his sample cases became separated from his personal luggage. In the ensuing confusion, the express, upon which he'd reserved a Pullman compartment, left without him. The next express was not due until Monday, a full 48 hours away. He would have to board a local and transfer at some place called Niebling. Even then, his arrival in the district capital would be delayed by more than a day. Time was money for a man like Villers, a commercial traveler. He didn't have the time or the money for nonsense such as this. The most important presentation of his trip awaited him at a convention in the capital. Villers was nervous about it already. On a one-to-one basis, seller to prospective buyer, he could hawk almost anything. His bright, beady eyes would fix upon his prey with mesmeric intensity. Accolades and proven bon mots flowed trippingly from his tongue. Villers spoke four languages and bragged that he could bargain with the likes of financiers or fishwives in half a dozen more. Yet begin to multiply his audience, and his finesse suddenly faded. With no single person to fasten upon, his eyes would flit anxiously about the room. All at once he was aware of his diminutive stature, a frayed cuff, the oversized mole on his left cheek. In the last week of his travels, an unbidden image of his forthcoming confrontation in Trebnica rose up again and again in his mind. Although he knew it had nothing to do with the reality he would eventually face and no doubt survive, he could not shake it. He saw a sea of unfamiliar faces all about him, indifferent or even hostile, waiting for him to fumble and make a fool of himself. The day was cold, cloudy, threatening further rain. The Stefanov station was poorly insulated. As Villers sat on the unyielding wooden benches, moving his small, wiry body from one to another with no purpose except to ease his nervousness, he felt the dampness begin to invade his bones. Arthritic premonitions twinged in his lower back and sent pinchers curving about his ribcage. His joints began to crack. Sickness was another thing he couldn't afford. But he wouldn't be sick, he told himself, not again. Forcefully lifting his thoughts from his surroundings, he visualized his flat in London, the fire burning in the grate, the slippered feet of his wife Sophie as she crossed the carpet bringing their evening tea. The wait was not long. As rain began to speckle the partitioned windows of the station, an ancient engine groaned into view. Villers soon found himself squeezed into a dingy and narrow car of questionable vintage. Making his way to a window seat, he noted his fellow travelers were exclusively of the lower classes. Peasant women, shapelessly hunched within their shawls, dark men who drank from bottles concealed in their coats and ate pieces of bread right from the loaf, breaking off the chunks with large, uneven teeth. Scampering children who seemed to belong to no one, or at least recognized no one's authority. In his suit and vest, Villers was uncomfortably aware of his relative affluence. He checked his watch chain to make sure it was securely fastened, shifted his billfold so that it was lodged deeply within his breast pocket. As Sophie had once warned him amidst the rumpled sheets of their conjugal bed, Some people will steal the gold out of your teeth if you give them half a chance. A conductor in blue gabardine ambled through the car, inspecting tickets in a cursory fashion. By fits and starts, the train jerked out of the station. On their outer surfaces, the windows of the car were spattered with soot, rendering the dismal landscape and cloud-dotted sky even more funereal. Whoever had occupied Villers' seat before him had leaned against the window glass, depositing amoeba-shaped patches of oil. He drew a handkerchief from his pocket, but rubbing only served to spread the greasy residue over a wider area. Scrubby trees, ditches, and plowed-over fields smeared by in a sickening blur. Rugged embankments shot up from nowhere, frighteningly close, and momentarily blocking the sky. Soon they reached the foothills and began to climb. The unrelenting landscape slowed to a crawl. The number of bodies packed into the car made Villers feel claustrophobic. Diverse odors mingled to a stench that was sweet and sour by turns, and at times washed through with pungent tides of garlic. Bottles passed, and peasant tongues soon loosened. As if in search of escape, their rough voices and the clatter of their ready laughter beat about the car. He felt increasingly out of place. Although he knew it was foolish, Villers kept thinking their laughter had something to do with him. At his hotel, he had breakfast lightly, expecting to lunch in a dining coach. This local didn't have a diner, and he cursed himself for failing to realize this sooner. At the same time, the atmosphere of the car was making him queasy. As the engine inched up slopes, it was never designed to conquer. Blatting its misery back along the line, the opposing sensation of hunger and nausea held a gurgling parley in the depths of his belly. The man in the next seat offered him a bite of bread, and Villers spied droplets of saliva dampening the crust. The world reeled. On the platform at the rear of the car, the remains of two buttered crullers and a cup of coffee spilled onto the passing tires. Back in his seat, he forced his eyes shut and managed to come upon a semblance of sleep. "Niebling! Niebling!" The call of the conductor brought his eyes open. The car had grown uncommonly quiet. Villers gathered himself and stumbled down the aisle. Before he was fully conscious, he found himself abandoned on a dilapidated wooden platform, his baggage in a jumble by his side. According to the schedule he had been shown in Stafanov, he would have less than an hour to wait for his connection to the district capital. Shivering in the cool mountain air, he reached into his vest pocket to check his watch. It was missing! Not only the watch, but the gold chain Sophie had given him to hold it. He cursed and cursed again, stamping his feet futilely against the bare boards. Waiting until his composure was restored, hauling his bags with him and puffing from the effort, Villers entered the station house, a low building of brick and mortar. The room was empty, except for a clerk, who sat behind a barred window. Villers approached, allowed his bags to clump to the floor, and cleared his throat for attention. The clerk glanced up. Beneath the glossy black visor of his cap, the man's face was unnaturally pale, beardless, with albino eyebrows lost in the blankness of his forehead. Peering at him through the bars, Villers was struck with the unpleasant image of a man locked within a cell, never seeing the sun. He didn't let this dissuade him. "I'm waiting for the train to Trebnica," Villers stated with authority. The man looked him up and down. Transparent lashes bordered his nearly colorless eyes. "That would be tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. The reply was toneless, in a dialect strangely clipped. It took a moment for comprehension to settle in to Villers. His lips flapped soundlessly. But, that can't be. I was supposed to make my connection here within the hour. The schedule has been incorrect for several weeks now," the clerk informed him indifferently. Villers stood rooted as waves of anxiety and exasperation swept through him. His mouth tasted foul. His belly was empty, and a steady ache had lodged itself at the base of his skull. Finally, he spoke with difficulty, in a controlled voice. "Will you watch my bags for me?" The clerk's eyes swiveled about the empty room as if gauging the absurdity of the request. Villers found the men's room at the side of the station and locked himself within its single stall. Without letting down his trousers, he collapsed upon the open seat. A series of hoarse sobs broke from his throat like soft choking. His vision fogged over. He could forget about his presentation. On one level, he felt a kind of relief, yet at the same time he realized that this entire trip was now a financial disaster. 2 months on the continent, and he'd be lucky to cover his expenses. When he had been a younger man, still single, and such misfortunes had befallen him, he would spend extra time on the road to compensate. Now that he was married and had responsibilities, things were different. He knew how Sophie pined for him while he was away, how she sat alone in their flat with little to do. She expected him home on a particular day, at a certain hour. Unless he wired ahead, she would be waiting by the dock to meet him. In either case, she'd be terribly upset, and Villers had few doubts about whom she would take it out on. He could already hear her tirade. He could almost feel the springs of their living room sofa having their way with his back muscles. He pulled out his handkerchief and blew into it several times. With a thin stream of water from the tap, he splashed his face clean. He patted it dry with the second handkerchief he always carried in his coat. As he surveyed himself in the mirror beneath the pale fluorescent lighting, which began the shadow of a flicker even as he watched, he had the strange impression that the glass, mounted flush against the wall, was actually a window, and that someone was watching him from the other side. Then he unconsciously met his own eyes and realized that the strangeness he felt was there. He noticed how mapped the cornea was with its web of veins, the growing map of wrinkles that surrounded it. They were his own eyes, and they stared back at him from his own face. At the same time, someone else seemed to be staring back at him from within that stare. Villers shook his head to dismiss the notion. He quickly turned and left the room. In the block behind the station, he came upon a hotel, probably the only in Niebling, he wagered. A modest and neat building of cream stucco, with latticed wood trim and wooden window boxes harboring trailing clusters of ivy. The lobby was large and well-kept, if a bit sparsely furnished. It seemed far too good a hotel for a town of which he'd never heard. Then Villers remembered he was in the mountains, and there was probably skiing here in the winter and a tourist season. He rang a silver bell tacked atop the counter. It echoed hollowly in the deserted lobby. Before the echo could die, almost instantaneously, a man appeared from behind a swinging door. Still more startling, this fellow had the same bleached countenance, the same pale eyes and hairless cheeks as the clerk at the station. Villers knew that in isolated villages with limited populations, a good deal of inbreeding went on. It was not uncommon for cousins to marry, or even closer relations to join in wedlock. Some genetic irregularity, he concluded, peculiar to the region. "Good afternoon, sir. Mr. Dubeck at your service. May I be of help in any way?" The man bustled about behind the counter, squaring off papers, gathering loose pencils and pens, and shoving them into a cardboard cup. "Yes, I'd like a room, for tonight only," Villers replied. He intended to go directly to the station in the morning. When the sun came up, he would be there. He would wait until his train arrived, and he would board it. There would be no more mistakes or delays. If he could talk to the right people in Trebnica, perhaps he could reschedule his presentation for later in the week. "But of course, sir, if you'll just sign our register." Dubeck spun a large book about and flapped it open, simultaneously handing Villers a pen. Villers wrote his name and printed his home address and occupation. The man spun the book back. "Ah, a commercial traveler." He beamed and nodded with delight. "I do hope your stay with us will be a pleasant and profitable one, sir." Unlike his twin at the station, though Villers could now see that this man was older and thinner, nearly emaciated, Dubeck proved overly solicitous rather than indifferent. He insisted on carrying Villers' luggage up to the room for him. Although he could barely manage the three bags and kept stumbling on the stairs, he refused to allow his guest to take even one. Both men, Villers thought, were exaggerations, almost caricatures of the courtesy that survived in better hotels and restaurants, the other of a spreading bureaucratic laxness one now encountered in all walks of life. The room, located on the second floor, appeared clean and quite adequate. For once, the bathroom was attached and private. He wouldn't have to go traipsing through the hall in robe and slippers to take his morning shave. After Dubeck left, Villers fell into a more thorough examination of his surroundings. The hotel was perched on high ground, and his window offered an excellent view of Niebling, which was larger than he expected and quite charming, with sun glinting off the church steeples and greenery lining the streets. Rather than laying out rectangular city blocks, the street ran round and about, up and down. Most of the buildings seemed to possess an archaic, pre-war flavor. Turning back to the room, he began to go through the bureau drawers. There was no telling what one might find. To his surprise, although it looked like wood, the bureau turned out to be made of cardboard, as was the nightstand. The bureau drawers were empty, yet in the single drawer of the nightstand he came upon what looked to be a business card. When he turned it over, only a single word was printed on it, embossed in an oblique cursive script. "Uxorius," it read. It may have been a playing card from some game. He should have known what the word meant. Perhaps once he had, but now it eluded him. He tucked the card into a side pocket of one of his cases. He would share it with Sophie when he got home, as he did all the odds and ends he gathered on his travels. It was well past noon, and Villers considered lunch. His ordeal on the train had left him out of sorts, suddenly far more tired than hungry. He decided to take a nap, and then treat himself to a special dinner to make up for his misfortunes. A generous helping of roast beef, perhaps some scalloped potatoes, and a few glasses of a decent burgundy, just enough to give him a glow. Dubeck had informed him that the hotel dining room would be open from 7 to 9. When he awoke, dusk already tinged the sky with purple. Rubbing the sleep out of his eyes, Villers watched from the window as lamplights flickered on in consecutive patterns throughout the streets of Niebling. The crystal mountain air made everything shine, even at this hour. He was impressed with such order and cleanliness. Water steamed from the bathroom tap. He splashed it across his face, and his normally ruddy complexion became still redder. He began to brush his well-barbered hair. Villers was proud of his hair. Unlike most of his contemporaries, it remained full and thick and as chestnut brown as when he was a young man. True, in the years since his marriage, he had developed a touch of gray in the sideburns. Sophie had assured him that this merely made him look distinguished rather than older. The lobby proved as deserted as before. A pair of high double doors appeared to be the only possible entrance to a dining room. As he approached, Villers could hear voices from behind him. He couldn't make out what they were saying, but it sounded as if they were delivering speeches. Not formal speeches, but the parts to a play. He hesitated momentarily before trying the doors, only to discover that they were locked. Perhaps it was not yet 7. Villers reached for his watch without thinking. His forefinger slid into the empty pocket. His features creased. He frowned as he crossed the lobby to ring the bell atop the counter. Dubeck made his entrance just as rapidly as before, as if he hung behind that swinging door with nothing to do but wait for the bell to sound. This time, Villers should have been prepared. Nevertheless, it startled him again. His heart bumped within his chest. "Yes, sir, Mr. Villers, how may I serve you, sir?" Dubeck actually bowed in expectation, his head bobbing up and down as he spoke. This fawning nature was beginning to annoy Villers. There was such a thing as being too helpful, too courteous. "Yes," Villers answered severely. "Could you tell me how soon they are going to open the dining room and begin serving dinner?" "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, sir," Dubeck blathered. "I'm afraid that's been, changed."
"Changed?"
Villers asked. What do you mean, changed? We seldom serve dinner this time of year, anyway. It's the off-season, and the business just doesn't warrant it. But... Villers was astonished. You told me dinner would be served between 7 and 9. I distinctly remember you telling me. Oh, no, sir, I'm afraid you've misunderstood. Not tonight. I am sorry. The same servile smile was strapped across Dubek's slack jowls, yet now he seemed to be eyeing Villers somewhat askance. What was the man, Villers thought, some kind of idiot? Had the genes which bled out his coloring also offset his mental processes? Without another word, Villers spun on his heel and strode out of the lobby, turning his shoulders beneath his coat to make certain that Dubek was aware of his displeasure. He was into the street and striding down it rapidly before he pulled up and took stock of his surroundings. This appeared to be a business district. There were numerous shops, all closed for the evening, but no sign of a restaurant or tavern where he might find a meal. He kept walking, allowing the immaculate streets and buildings to console him. Yes, he thought, this was the kind of town he and Sophie could retire to someday. Quiet, peaceful, clean, and well-ordered. But Villers had more immediate problems. His headache had returned, and his hunger seemed suddenly immense. Somewhere he'd heard that the digestive juices, with nothing to work on, eventually began eating away the stomach wall itself. He'd already been treated twice for a nascent ulcer, and Sophie had been put to the trouble of preparing a special diet for him. Villers now moved into a residential district, and the way the streets ran up and down, round and about, he quickly lost sight of the hotel. He wasn't even sure about the direction he was following. And the most peculiar thing was that no one else seemed to be on the streets. It was chilly out, but hardly inclement enough to drive people indoors. The evening was still early. There should have been at least a few souls running errands, visiting friends and neighbors. All at once, Villers had the strange impression that the city was, for the most part, devoid of life. The buildings only cardboard mock-ups, like the bureau in his room. Increasingly confused, probably lost, he paused beneath a street lamp. Above him, the clear globe of the lamp shone as if it had been polished that very day. The sidewalk beneath his feet was spotless, no dirt, no paper or leaves. As he looked about helplessly, his eyes fastened on the second-story window of a nearby house. The room was dark, yet the curtains had been drawn back, and there was a man watching him from that window. He could make out the light blotch of his face, his dark hair. And then he noticed that in the next house, another man, or perhaps it was a woman, had taken up an identical position and was also staring at him. At least they weren't albinos, Villers thought, yet the nerve of it! Was he some kind of freak that he should be examined like this? Didn't people walk the streets of Niebling at night? Villers had half a mind to stare back until the pair retreated in embarrassment. But no, he concluded, that would be stooping to their level. Instead, he struck off in a new direction. Soon, he was bound to come upon somebody or something. He would ask directions. He would have his dinner, and he would enjoy it. The path he had chosen wound steeply downhill. As he approached the end of the descent, he understood that he had reached the center of town. He saw a circular park and several imposing buildings, columned with blocky masonry. As the impressions of Niebling had gathered in his mind, his sense of its size had increased. And this he didn't understand. At first, he had taken it for a village. Then, a small town. Now, it appeared as a city of moderate size. From the far side of the park, Villers heard voices passing to him through the night air. Between the trees, he could make out a group of people moving haltingly down the street in some kind of procession. At last, he'd be able to ask about a restaurant. He skirted the darkness of the park, walking briskly. When he reached the further side, the scene which he came upon was so strange that his initial intentions were swept from his mind. There were 20-odd men and women standing in a loose circle. In the center of the ring they formed, a man and a woman, both albino, were having some kind of argument. In spite of the pale skin, the pair didn't even look like they belonged in Niebling. They wore the colorful clothes of gypsies, and their features had a Mediterranean cast. The language they spoke was not the native tongue, and Villers could only make out a word here or there. The man was doing most of the talking, actually shouting, and when the woman answered, her voice was tortured and subdued. From what Villers could gather, it was some kind of domestic quarrel. The man was accusing her of infidelities, hurling a slew of vile names at her. He would advance and raise his hand as if he were about to deliver a blow. The woman would retreat, taking several steps backwards, and the circle of observers would follow. In this way, the entire tableau was progressing slowly down the street. Villers' reaction was to feel embarrassed for the couple. Still, he thought, it was their own fault for airing their dispute in such a public place. Yet what of the citizens of Niebling? Weren't they to blame also? They should have been ashamed of themselves for standing and gawking at the unfortunate pair. Then, as he continued to watch, he began to reevaluate his perceptions. Despite the man's apparent anger, there was something in his manner that didn't ring true. Momentarily, he would notice the crowd. He would look around, quite conscious of the watching faces and the fact that he was making a spectacle of himself. Rather than inhibiting his actions, this appeared to drive him on. He would renew his shouting. His arms would wave more wildly. At the same time, his eyes often seemed elsewhere, lacking the force and violence of his movements. Finally, as he advanced upon the woman with his arm raised, she failed to retreat. He swung at her with his open palm. Closing her eyes, the woman actually seemed to turn her head so the blow fell squarely upon her cheek. The noise of the slap resounded through the empty street. The crowd remained silent, motionless. The man swung with his other arm, and the woman repeated the same inexplicable action, as if it were all rehearsed. Yet the blows were real enough. The woman's colorless face flushed deeply with the rising blood. She fell to her knees, clasping the man's legs and apparently begging his forgiveness. After a few seconds, he lifted her and, supporting her with one arm, began to walk. The ring of observers parted for their passage, then began to move themselves, spreading out, some into the park, others in various directions down the street. No words were exchanged. No one commented upon the incident. Only Villers remained, standing where he was, completely baffled. Then he noticed a policeman among the watchers. At least, he wore a very policeman-like uniform, and at his side, on a leather thong, he carried a wooden stick like a London bobby. This odd town of Niebling was posing one problem after another for Villers. This one he would get to the bottom of. Approaching the officer directly, he adopted his most officious manner. "Pardon me, I'm a stranger in these parts." His voice sounded out of place in the now silent street. "I couldn't help wondering what was going on here. It looked as if those people were acting for an audience, as if they were paid performers." The officer was tall, and he looked down on Villers as he answered. "No one paid them, sir. They were merely being themselves, acting out the roles they had chosen. If others chose to watch, that is their prerogative." "But you are an officer of the law," Villers persisted. "If they weren't acting, why, that man actually struck the woman. Why didn't you do something?" The officer eyed Villers suspiciously. Apparently, he didn't like his authority or the local customs being questioned. "You say you are a stranger here, sir. May I see your papers, please?" "Now, just a—" Villers was about to protest, but the words died upon his lips. He remembered tales of small-town authorities puffed up with their own importance, of travelers detained for days or even weeks over a trumped-up technicality merely because they had annoyed some petty bureaucrat. Further, he noticed this policeman looked to be a mean and dissolute sort. more than a day's growth of stubble dirtied his cheeks and chin. "Your papers, sir," the man repeated. He raised his club with one hand and placed it carefully in the palm of the other. Several onlookers from the dissipating crowd had now returned, and from a distance were observing this new interchange. Villers reached for his wallet, then, with a sinking feeling, remembered he had left his papers in his room. After all, he had only been going downstairs for dinner. Frantically, he sought for an explanation. "I'm at the hotel," he began. If he had ever noticed the name of the establishment, it had now slipped his mind. I must have left my papers there, on the bureau. Mr. Dubeck, the manager, he'll vouch for me. My train schedules were confused. I'm only staying in Niebling overnight. I'm taking the train to Trebnica in the morning. Mr. Dubeck. The officer chuckled. He had a large mouth, protruding teeth. A man like that, I'm afraid his word is not worth much. Why, he's hardly a man at all. And besides, sir, you are quite mistaken. There is no train between Niebling and Trebnica. Villers stared at him in disbelief. Of course there was a train. Hadn't the clerk informed him it would arrive in the morning? This man was toying with him, playing some kind of malicious trick. I'm afraid you'll have to come with me, sir. More people had returned to watch, and Villers looked around, increasingly unsure of the situation. They stood tall and silent, with gaunt faces and bony foreheads. Their eyes were upon him, staring intently, awaiting his response. His limbs began to tremble. The pain in his skull pulsed, and something writhed within his thoughts. He could feel it, alien and alive, a loose tentacle slithering past his consciousness to the depths of his being. A chill sweat broke from his pores like an attack of ague. Nausea filled his imagination. "Sir?" Villers understood at last why he could not find a restaurant in Niebling. It was something other than food that its inhabitants consumed. And even as he tried to deny this revelation, as he tried to convince himself he was still back at his hotel, asleep in his bed, immersed in a distended nightmare from which he would soon awaken, he could feel the minds about him infesting his own, drawing sustenance from his fears and confusion. He took a step back. He raised one hand to his temple to massage away the pain in his skull, and his palm came away damp with moisture. The officer reached for his arm. The circle of onlookers about him was nearly complete. Villers turned and ran. He brushed past several men and women, his Oxford slipping for traction on the pavement. He ran blindly, picking streets at random, turning a corner here, finding an alley there. At the edge of his vision, he could sense more than see the open curtains, a blur of faces in the dark windows. At last he entered another business district, free from the houses with their prying eyes. His heart was pounding dangerously, his throat convulsed, unable to pull his breath fast enough. Villers bent over, choking, and fell to one knee. As he looked up, by the light of the polished street lamps, his reflection appeared before him in a shop window. His ruddy cheeks had been blanched of all color. His hair was whiter than the tablet of writing paper he carried in his valise. As he grappled with this transformation, some trick of the lighting, he told himself, he tried to stand and continue his flight. Then he heard them at the end of the block, coming for him. Once more, Villers felt them invade the open labyrinth of his thoughts. He cried out for a moment from the pain, and then he was silent. The last of his will had been stripped away. In the far distance of his mind's eye, they showed him Sophie. She was flying toward him upon a black, star-studded ground. She seemed impossibly large. Her skirts billowed. Her lips were taut. Arms and legs spread, as if she had been crucified upon the wind. He understood that he would have to send for her. He would tell her to take the train and meet him in Trebnica. Only the schedules would be changed. just as they had for him. He and his wife would be together again soon, and they would take up residence in Niebling. Sophie would never forgive him for any of it. She would revile him constantly, tirelessly, enumerating all of his faults and failures. And the eyes of the crowd would be upon them.
Dear God, they finally found out. They know the awful truth, and soon the Navy will be in Douglas Bay, and stern-faced Marines will come ashore, only to find that the Isle of Man is completely deserted, and seemingly always has been. The building suggests stage fronts, the roads are painted on, the ships, old, rotten hulks. They'll search, and they'll find nothing, and in the end, the entire incident, the entire island, will be quietly covered up, quietly destroyed. Then, some years from now, a small, friendly coastal community will appear somewhere in Europe, and the cycle will begin again. There's a Charles Fort quote I've always loved, because it's both remarkably horrid and shot through with a sort of jet-black humour that suggests Fort would have been at home in a kinder, somewhat less ruthless, White Street society. It runs like this. I think we're cattle. Fort, you see, believed everything and believed nothing. He was consistently fascinated by the universe and tried on new models of understanding it, like other people try on coats. He loved knowledge in the same way that Richard Feynman did, that Henry Rollins does, and that's why he, along with those two men, are numbered amongst my heroes. This story, for me, embodies all the best images and deepest horror of Fort's quote, not just that there are things out there that hunt us, but that those things are everywhere, and they look and sound just like you and me. Sleep well. Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors and cover our costs, and this was just one time, I assure you, pay off Big Tony. So if you feel like making our authors, or indeed Big Tony's day, then please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you will not regret it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Pseudopod wants to know, how old would she be now, the girl you failed to save?